Hey, it's Melvin, one of your friendly neighborhood podcast hosts. Whether it's your first time tuning in or you're a longtime listener, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever. Reviews are the lifeblood of the podcast world, so if you want to help us out, it'll take only a moment of your time. Otherwise, we hope you enjoy the show. You're listening to Cinematic Doctrine.
But hey, if you just press play, you're missing out on 32 minutes of content. I have a guest today, Tyler Banark, as I was corrected. Not that made it sound like he did it vehemently. It was very kind the way he did it. But we'll introduce him more formally and appropriately later in a minute. But you're missing out on 32 minutes of content wherein we talk about, as of right now, there is a current semi kind of existing bidding war on Coyote versus Acme again. This is another project that was killed by David Zaslav at Warner Brothers, then brought back and then killed again, and then less than 24 hours brought back again. We're recording on February 13th, so perhaps there's been some changes since then. But with that in mind, we focused our conversation on the, I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say ethics, that implies more of a moral discussion, but just like how are we feeling about Warner Brothers just like for 2 years, since 2021, since Batgirl, just like treating these movies, they are products. It is an industry, that's fair, but it's also still art. It's still a lot of investment and time from a massive collection of people being killed outright and then never seeing the light of day. That is weird, especially for people like us who just love movies, who love seeing movies, not just as entertainment, but also something to bite and chew on. So we talk about that for 32 minutes. Patreon supporters get access to that when they support for $3 a month on Patreon. You get a bunch of other benefits, which you'll hear about every 10 to 15 minutes while you're listening to this episode. So I won't belabor that. But yeah, do it. It's great. I think you're going to get a lot of good benefits for the rest of all the other episodes that you've been listening to. You can get that right at the beginning of every episode whenever you press play. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes of content each. But we are going to be doing an episode on a movie discussion episode on The Menu. This came out in 2022. But before we get into the specifics of our discussion on The Menu, let me now officially, formally, actually introduce Tyler Banark. Hi, Tyler Banark. What's going on, my guy?
Hello, Melvin. Thank you so much for letting me come on here. I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk about this movie, and it's gonna be a fun one to talk about. So
I was able to get connected with Tyler because I don't remember how. Maybe it was just Instagram, just putting people in front of me on the feed. But then I really liked your style of how you posted on there. And just like, I found it super simple, and I was good at Facebook. That's what I was good at. And then at some point I realized I was old and too old and just decided I was off social media. Now I'm back. And I just was like, man, he's got it with the way he uses his visuals to just like tell you his rating and then put his thoughts down the bottom. If you want to follow Tyler, go on to Instagram. His username, if you search Tyler Banark, I'm sure it'll just show up. But Tyler Banark Reviews Movies is the particular username. So before we talk about The Menu, I wanted to talk to you about, you said you were in this thing. You've even mentioned it a couple times while we've been talking, the League of Cinephiles. What the heck is the League of Cinephiles?
Yeah. So, the League of Cinephiles is a YouTube channel that started about 3 years ago. I was approached by this guy named Alex Helmer who created the League, and he basically the same thing like you did, like you just straight up, like I opened up Instagram, saw a random DM in my messages and was just like, hey, I'm nice. Doing this thing. I was wondering if you could, if you want to come on at some time. And I was like, okay, sure. And, I came on, and at the time it was originally called Helmer's Movie Mania Podcast. And like, it started out like with us just doing like these videos called Cinema Wars, where we had like little movie debates, and like, we have like a little prompt, and like, you know, we talk about it. And then, you know, like each round, like we have another prompt, and like one by one, people get eliminated. And then like a month. And so cool. Like we did one episode of it. And then we did another one, and then another one, and then another one. And eventually a month into it, by March, you know, Alex decided to create the League of Cinephiles. Mm-hmm. And, You know, it's been something we've been doing for, you know, like I said, 3 years. We didn't meet in person until September of 2022 when we went to the Toronto International Film Festival. And so it was really special, like, you know, meeting all the guys in person and, you know, finally, being in the same room as them physically. We're starting up we're about 4 seasons in. We're about to start our fourth season and our final one, unfortunately, starting very soon. I think this month, I would say. If you like watching movie trivia and, like, you know, love guys talking about people talking about, you know, film debates and whatnot, feel free to check us out. It's League Cinephiles on YouTube or TLOC Productions on Instagram. You will not regret it if you go check us out.
I'll make sure to have another link for that too in the show notes. I know you also were mentioning, so because for the listener, for listeners, they definitely know I haven't had a new guest on for a long time. So I made a rubric yesterday to help us get prepared. And so you were, I just asked you outright. I was like, hey, what are some things that you would want me to ask you about? And obviously, and I don't know why I didn't think of this in general, but favorite movies and actors. I mean, that's one I just have to put on the rubric anyway. I'll ask two questions about favorite movies. Okay. We'll start with this one. What is your outright, like, currently, and this is an impossible question for people who love movies, what is your current favorite movie?
Well, that's actually a kind of a simple answer for me because I'm back and forth between two. Mm-hmm. And they are Pulp Fiction and Whiplash. I love those movies. Pulp Fiction is like, I find it so easy to rewatch. Mm-hmm. And like, I almost find something new, like, every single time I rewatch it. And then Whiplash, it's just probably like one of the most intense movies I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. It's a great movie. You know, it introduced us to Damien Chazelle. J.K. Simmons gives like one of the most terrifying performances I've seen from anyone. I would even go as far as to say Terrence Fletcher is scarier than like every single horror movie villain I've ever seen. I would go that far as to say that.
He might be the scariest Blumhouse villain. Just outright.
Yeah. 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 It's like I'm back between those two. And like, I love them for both, you know, for whatever reason. But those two are definitely like the, you know, the quintessential favorite movie of Tyler Banhart.
The other question I had was, because I found this to be interesting. This is something for myself that I was not expecting. But do you have a favorite movie that you've like posted about or reviewed, like that as you were reviewing it, you realized, oh, this is like a lot more than I thought or gave it credit for? I know that's sort of an odd question and perhaps one that's a little more poignant than to just throw on you like on the spot. Yeah. But yeah, I'm curious.
So when you say more than what I thought it would be, is this like a movie that like I thought I liked initially, then I was writing it, I liked it less, or
either, frankly.
So recently I went and saw The Zone of Interest. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it, I thought it was good. I thought it was a well-made film. But I wasn't sure, you know, how to rate it and like, you know, where I would put it. And like, it's like, you know, at one point, you know, the technicality of the film is fantastic. But on the other side, you know, if there's not much to the movie other than, you know, you get introduced to these characters and like you get and like they establish, you know, what the atmosphere of the film is like. Mm-hmm. So I was tough on whether or not what to rate it, but I landed on a 3.5 just because I thought it was safe. And looking back on it now, I think that was the right choice.
3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5. Yep.
That's I mostly asked that last question just because I found as I've been like, even since I started using Letterboxd, like since like 2016, and even before that, I did my anime list. So because I watched a lot of anime then, so I would do a lot of reviews there. I just found like the way I process through a lot of the stuff I'd seen. Sometimes my opinions would stay the same from when I watched it, but then sometimes my opinions would be like stronger or more like you just said, even more like definitive. Like, yep, I made the right choice. Like that, it's just so interesting. And even when as we're getting into the menu now, there's definitely a lot of that too that I had when watching it. Hey, don't forget, there's a lot of fun content missing from this episode because you're not listening on Patreon.
head over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and support for $3 a month to gain access to uncut episodes with upwards of 40 minutes of bonus content each. You'll thank me later.
So yeah, the menu, 2022, Mark Mylod is the director. Mylod, who knows how to pronounce a last name like that. But he's the director for a couple other movies, but mostly television. The other movies being What's Your Number and Ali G Into House, which I thought was funny to see. Although I guess that's, you know, such a long time ago, he's basically a different person. But he's also directed various television episodes. He's more known for producing wildly popular adult television. So he's basically produced a third of Shameless, a third of Entourage, and then pretty much all of Succession. So he's
Succession, baby.
So he's definitely a, like, even though he hasn't done a lot of movies, he knows what he's doing. So movie is starring Anya Taylor-Joy, the queen that she is. We got Nicholas Hoult and then Ralph Fiennes and various others. Other character actors. So I always like to just start with, like, for the menu, like, what do we think of the movie? We're not really a podcast that worries too much about spoilers, but just out of pacing, I find they usually work better at the end. But what did you think of the menu when you saw it?
When I saw the menu, I went to an early screener for it like 10 days before it came out. And, I was on board with it right away. I had a couple of friends who went to the world premiere of it at TIFF, and they loved it too. And they even said, like, at the like after they left, they were like walking out of the theater, and there was a food truck themed to the movie, and they were passing out like cheeseburgers. Ugh,
that just sounds so good.
I didn't see the menu at TIFF, but after seeing it, I really wished I had. And in regards to the movie itself, I was on board with it. I'm like, okay, Alex and Gall said this movie is amazing. Believe the hype. They were right. That movie is incredible. And I think it's Anya Taylor-Joy's best performance, like, in not like of her whole career, because I think that her performance in The Queen's Gambit is her best.
Ooh, yes.
But I think about the movies I've seen, I think her performance in The Menu is probably my favorite of hers. And then Ralph Fiennes, you know, he's excellent as well.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, Menu is an overall, like, amazing film from, like, every single aspect you can think of, and it easily cracked my top five of 2022.
Yeah, I think what's impressive is, like, so when people go into the Menu, they're just going to be like, oh, okay, it's a rich people dinner movie that has maybe a cult going on, which is exactly what I thought when the trailer played, which makes sense. That's what the trailer says. But the trailer, like, didn't capture me. So I didn't actually see this movie, I think my letterbox said January 7th. By that point, it had been out since November. So, like, I really slept on it. My wife and I were like, you know what? It's January. It's not like there's anything else to see. Let's just catch up on what we missed. And, like, we were just happy that, like, the way it eased into itself with, like, these characters get onto this boat. They're going off to an island where this restaurant is, and then they're going to have this dinner that's super fancy and expensive. What captured us from the start is the performances, pretty much like you're saying, are so professional. Like, this is a film where every person just knows what job they're doing and how to do it precisely. Yeah. When I stepped out, I was like, man, that Anya Taylor-Joy's good. Like, she is so good. And bless her for picking weird movies and continuing to do so. She has not gone the Dwayne The Rock Johnson route where she's like, I'm gonna do this and only this forever, or be
a typecast.
Like, she is just continues to pick weird projects where she looks outright silly in The Northman sometimes, even during her monologue at the end, and yet, like, there's so much, like, good in her breaking through that. I've yet to watch her or see her in something I haven't enjoyed. Yeah. What did you think? You said this was, like, one of your top five movies in 2023. Or 2022. I'm curious, what were amongst the others? Like, what is the grouping that the Menu's in right at this time?
Yeah. So at number five is The Batman. Which I think, like, when I did my mid-year, mid-year superlatives, I think The Batman was number one, I want to say.
Is that, like, you look back and, or Like, is that like an early rating before you get to the end of the year?
So
that's cool.
About like when it gets to about like June, July of that year, like June, July of each year, I would do like a best of blank year so far.
Yeah, and, that's cool.
And I remember correctly from 2022, my number one was the Batman. Mm-hmm. So, but that fell at number five. They got the menu at four. And then number three is this movie on Apple TV Plus called Cha-Cha Real Smooth. It's like a dramedy, I would say. Mm-hmm. For listener, if you don't know, it was this movie that came out on Sundance 2022, biggest hit of the festival. Apple bought it, and it's about this guy who just finished college and is like, you know, trying to find a place what to do next. Mm-hmm. And he's got like a brother who's in middle school, and he gets the idea to become a DJ at like bar and bat mitzvahs. And there he meets this woman and her teenage daughter who has autism, and he becomes like really, really close to both of them. It's a really, really amazing movie, and like it really mm-hmm. resonated with me. And like, well, let me ask this, Melvin, has there ever been a movie where you watched it and you're like, man, this movie hit me at the right time in my life. I saw it at the right time.
This is the worst. I felt so good that you asked me a question because I'm so used to being the host. So it's nice to ask the question. But I'm about to give you the worst answer. So I was down. And I felt awful. And I was like, I just want to go to a movie by myself. It wasn't like me and my wife were at a problem or anything. Me and Kat have always pretty much been great. But it was just like, I just want to go out and like just watch a movie and sit in a dark room and have a giant screen fed into my eyeballs. And the only thing in theaters, this is like 2019, or 18. The only thing in theaters that was like marginally interesting was Breakthrough. That weird, like pseudo faith-based movie where it was like the kid falls into the ice.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, I heard this movie's okay. I'm going to go see it. I bawled like a child. And I was like, I can't believe it. I feel pathetic. Can I even go home? Like, I felt, it was crazy. But like something about it just like was like really compelling to me. And also the movie was well directed. It was pretty good. But like, it just hit. And I left home, but I said to Catherine, I was like, I can't believe it. And she's like, your eyes are red. Were you crying? I was like, I feel awful. I can't believe it. It was just terrible. But like, yes, I get it though. Like sometimes you just see something and like, boom, it's there. If you saw it at any other time, it wouldn't matter. If I saw Breakthrough now, and I found it at a thrift store, so I was like, yeah, sure, I'll pick it up. But like, if I watch it now, I'd be like, cheesy, not that good. But if I saw it at the right time, which I did, it very much hit. So I totally get that. Man, the power of movies and timing. Oh, man.
So like for me, Cha-Cha Real Smooth was that because like I graduated college December of 2021. Mm-hmm. And like I wasn't sure, you know, where my life was going to go, like what to do with my life. But 6 months later, I see Cha-Cha Real Smooth, and like that, you know, it gave me that closure that like, you know, and like it gave me something to relate to.
Nice.
So that was my number three. And then my number two is Babylon. I love that movie. It's Damien Chazelle going all in and all out. And I wish that, you know, people understood it, but just people didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And then my number one film, my favorite movie of 2022 was Steven Spielberg's The Fabelmans, which I saw at a TIFF, and it was absolutely magical, especially the fact that Steven Spielberg was at that screening too.
And cool.
It was awesome. Amazing experience. So
then you had the menu at number four. So it was really high.
Number four.
That's wild. Yeah. Not in a bad way. Like that's because it's a good movie. Like, what a good top five too. There's such a good mixture of like chaos in there. It's mm-hmm. so great. Oh man.
But yeah, listen, if you haven't seen Cha-Cha Real Smooth, check it out on Apple TV Plus.
There's, you know, Apple TV Plus is like the one streamer that like everyone goes, but it's like, probably every 2 months I keep hearing, you gotta check this out. It's huge. And it's like, mm-hmm. they just end up being huge. Their collection, their ability for, what's the term? Curation is so good.
Yeah.
Man alive.
You may not know this, but the easiest way you can show your support for Cinematic Doctrine is to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. So press pause and share your thoughts. We'd love to hear what you have to say. and then press play again so you can hear the rest of the show.
Yeah, with the menu, like I think like what I found so comforting when watching the menu was that it was really well directed and evenly paced, so that like as it's doing everything that it does, I never, similar to a chef working on a meal and having to prepare it for you, when you have people who are very well versed in their craft, it ends up coming out really strong. Where like, yeah, I saw the menu very high up on a lot of people's lists. And that was a year I just kept going to the movies. So like, it is high up on mine too, in comparison to everything. So like, if you haven't seen the menu yet, like now is the time to do it, because one, it's funny and accessible as a horror movie, quote unquote. It's more of a thriller on that side, but it's horror in the sense that it's got this cult. But
that's why I've been saying, I like, everyone says it's a horror movie. I'm like, it's more of a thriller than a horror movie, but the yes, fact that you say more of a thriller, I'm so glad I'm not the only one who feels that way. So thank you, Melvin.
Gosh, I feel like it's the issue is like, once you put a cult in it, it's like it's transitioned to horror because people think Satan. It's like, no, this is salt, not Satan. They're not doing anything else. Like, it is just cooking. So just watch it. And like, then people are like, oh yeah, it's great. It's kind of like how Annihilation isn't really a horror movie. It has a horror scene in it, and it's a good scene. It's not a horror movie. It's a weird science fiction movie. But yeah, I do think that the movie has its troubles. I think the movie, one of my notes just says produced by Adam McKay, which, yeah, if you're familiar with him, you know, like he's the kind of guy who tells you what his movie's about on Twitter, because he is the guy who did that. And so this movie is it's very cleverly put together. And then some of the lines are very like, it is like taking two pieces of wood and just knocking them together. It's like, yes, that is exactly the noise. I understand. but you know, it never affected my experience with the movie. It never got in the way. And honestly, it just made it, go down easy, which is what I would want from food anyway. And so in that regard, it just came together. I just feel like that. So you've already mentioned that like you connected with Cha-Cha real smooth. Did you read anything that you kind of connected with into the menu, or that you, in terms of its message or theming, that you really enjoyed or appreciated, or maybe didn't?
I'd say, I mean, the only thing like, you know, I could like, you know, like first thing I could pinpoint was that you know, I don't know if it would count as like working like the food service industry, but my very first paying job ever, like when I was in my high school job, was being a dinner server at a retirement home. So like I kind of, you know, I can sort of relate to it in that way. So like for in terms of experience, I'd say that. But just like in like the story, like in and of itself, I don't know. I guess like, I mean, I guess Julian Slowick, Ralph Fiennes' character, you know, I guess, you know, I could kind of see where his story kind of makes sense, where like, you know, he wants to be like, you know, I mean, he's already a really well acclaimed chef. Like, I mean, that's made very obvious. And, you know, he wants to be, you know, the best at his craft, regardless of, you know, like how lengthy he goes to accomplish that. And I think that's something that we can, you know, I can kind of see myself doing too. You know, I mean, I wouldn't go like too far to the point where like I lose my sanity over it, but like, you know, I want to like, you know, I always feel like, you know, I want to be, you know, I want to better myself at, you know, whether it's something, whether like, you know, it's, you know, being a film critic or as a person, you know, I want to, you know, I just want to make sure, you know, I want to be the best version of me at this. And, you know, of course, you know, like I said, Julian takes it, you know, to the extreme of like losing his sanity and being psychotic, but yeah.
Yeah. I really kind of connected with like that tension that the movie has, where like one of my notes just says like service work hell, where like you have this frustrating dynamic wherein like in the restaurant system, like we're all our fellow man, but then the service worker has to like, they're nice to you, but they're not nice to you necessarily because like they like you. They're nice to you because it's their job. They're being paid to do it.
Yep.
And if they don't do it well, then they lose wages. Or in the case of like restaurant work, even like the dynamic is made more difficult when tipping is legal in the at all ever. So like, yeah. So then there's this way in which like their kindness is, I would say, appropriately utilized for the goals that we passively give into when we go to a restaurant, which is, this is about somebody's job. And then when you're there to eat, like you aren't wrong to have like particular expectations about what is provided, so-and-so, whatever. But like the dynamics get muddled when like it supersedes or oversteps its boundary or like becomes like unkindness or like this idea wherein like the food critic, because they are probably very much aware of the fact that they've made like Ralph Fiennes's character, Slowick, because she gave him a good review and now Hawthorne is on the map. Mm-hmm. There's like, oh, he might be like the chef who makes me the food. And if he poisons it and I eat it, I die. But he has to also remember that I'm the one that put on the map. So I'm above him. So the movie, like throughout it, constantly has this awareness of who's on top, who's on top, who's on bottom, what's going on, and which one are we going to be? And you look like you had a thought on that.
Yeah, because I remember, like I said, there's that one character, the critic that comes to, that's one of the patrons at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Can't remember who the actress's name was, but she gave a good review once of Julian Slowick's work, you know, and it launched his career. Mm-hmm. But like in the instance of the menu, you know, the reason why she's there and like he's, you know, kind of, you know, avenging, you know, or like writing their wrongs in his way is because, you know, she gave a bad review of several restaurants and they closed down because of her. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, I can see that as part of it, a big part of it too.
Yeah. Janet McTeer is the actor. IMDb mm-hmm. was not working earlier, so I didn't have it open, but now I do. And like everybody at each table, I would almost say like one of the best choices of the film is that each of the patrons, they have their own table, and then each table, the camera will continue to hover around and follow them and show you like, what are they talking about? How do they communicate? And then mm-hmm. the script does well to like, whenever it pivots to the next character who's talking, script and editing come together to help us like never feel jumbled or confused about what's going on. And that continues to speak to the talent of the, really the whole team. They're just putting it out of the park, but you get like a relationship where like you have this, the person who's just named movie star, John Leguizamo, which is of course good casting, who's sitting there with his, I guess it's like his PR manager. I can't remember who they specifically say she is, but an employee. And then like, yeah, you have this critic and then maybe like an assistant who's like the yes man of the critic, a husband and wife who are very old
and have been regular patrons to that restaurant.
Exactly. Yeah.
To Hawthorne.
You keep having like, and even to that point, like you have regulars at restaurants or regulars who are customers. There's this odd dynamic where like, sometimes they like get, I don't mean it in a negative way, but they get chummy with you. And it's like, remember, I'm supposed to be nice to you to sell things to you. So like, we're not necessarily friends. Let's be careful. I'll be kind to you, but it's that you don't need to talk to me when I'm going somewhere, but I digress. It's, the whole film is aware of these things and find ways to occasionally subtly work with that. And then occasionally very, very obtusely work with that as well. And it just keeps doing that. That definitely combines with the other thing that I thought of, which was class war dynamics. I thought that was definitely present too, but much more, I think, the service work thing. But the class war stuff goes, I think, hand in hand with some of that cult style stuff. Enjoying this episode? Grab that share link and tell your friends. Word of mouth is the most effective way for a podcast to reach new listeners. So don't be shy. Share the episode wherever you can. But I feel like there's so many more specifics that we can talk about when we have spoilers more open. So I guess we'll transition into that, unless you had any other things to say that you just wanted to say to encourage a listener who may not have seen it.
I'd say another thing I would encourage, if you haven't checked it out yet, is the score in the movie is also amazing. Gosh, I love it too.
Colin Stetson.
Colin Stetson, who also scored Hereditary, which is, personally, it's my favorite movie of 2018. Mm-hmm. So hearing his work in something else outside of Hereditary was great to hear. And he absolutely killed it in The Menu, especially during the cheeseburger scene.
Yeah, and gosh, even to that end, there was totally a note I had about Constantine. Was it on here? But basically, like, the movie feels like a mixture of a lot of other movies. We haven't mentioned this, but if you see Midsommar, there's a bit of that into this, because obviously, because of the cult stuff, but not to the point where it's like, oh, if it's got a cult in it, it's like Midsommar. But more in the sense, like, it literally has that, like, going off into a foreign place that feels different and otherworldly. also feels like, now, of course, these were being made kind of at the same time. Feels kind of like The Bear, wherein, like, the stress of service work is definitely a backdrop. It's not present in the movie, but it's a backdrop to the story. And The Bear, of course, has a lot of that dynamic as well. And the chasing of perfection, or not even just perfection, but self-satisfaction, that is present also. So they have a bit of that. The movie very much pulls from a lot of those things. And I think that just happens when you have a team come together and just put in a bunch of ideas that they not only like, but they're really good at. And yes, Colin Stetson's score, like, you get to it and you're like, oh, that's definitely that. It's got the swinging, rotating, oscillating brass instruments. It's got to be him. And then, yeah, it ends up being him. Yeah, so if you haven't checked it out, you got to check it out. But also, we're going to be getting into spoilers. The movie does have spoilers, so I think it's fair to say, like, if you don't care to watch the movie, or you don't care about spoilers, stick around. But if you do want to watch a movie with some good shocks and surprises, and you want to go through it as the menu is intended, which I think is probably the point, definitely check it out. I think right now it's on HBO. It's on Max.
Yeah.
But
it's on Max.
I realize I've been kicking off each section, so I'll pass this to you for the more spoiler stuff. But were there any, like, was there a particular scene, spoiler-wise, that really, like, caught you off guard or really got you engaged or that you liked, or maybe any symbols or iconography?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to the iconography, recurring sentiment, all that stuff, one thing that jumped out to me right away was, so whenever Julian introduced a course, you know, he would let out a huge clap and, you know, all the chefs would stop what they're doing for a split second. And he would go on to talk about the meal and they would proceed, you know, with what they're doing. I noticed that throughout, like, the entire Iron movie, like, he would always, that's, like, kind of his thing. Mm-hmm. And then towards the very end, Margot decides to, like, stand up and she decides to do a loud clap. And, like, that's kind of like, I always kind of felt like that, you know, that's, like, you know, that's Julian's way of commanding the room. And so when Margot says, throw it back at him and say, you know what, I don't like your food. I want to send it back. And, you know, she relays that whole monologue of, you know, how he's ruined, you know, the, you know, kind of like the experience of eating food and, you know, how disastrous of a experience has been, like, outside from, like, you know, all the shocks that have happened. And, you know, she lays it all on him and is like, and you know what the funny thing is? I'm still hungry.
Yeah. It's so good. So good. And it's a good contrast too, to the fact that, like, the beginning of the dinner starts with don't eat. Sit and savor, chew, but don't eat, which of course is, like, you know, the point and the metaphor of it is to, like, when you have this food, like, let it linger, which is a contrast, but also kind of a new version of it is kind of what she's getting into, which is definitely interesting.
But, like, what I also kind of love about it too is that, you know, like I said earlier, you know, like, when Margot decides to take a stand, you know, she's taking all the self-absorption that she's, that Julian's thrown at her and throwing it right back at him.
Yes.
So, like, you know, he's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a sense of, like, you know, you know, he's getting a taste of his own medicine. And when she asks for, you know, for him to make a cheeseburger, it's a callback to, you know, his first job. Because as we learned that, you know, Julian, his whole cooking career started working at a fast food restaurant and, you know, flipping burgers at it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, feel like the fact that, like, she's bringing that back up and, you know, and she's kind of in control now. She just mentally destroys him and he's thought, like, okay, how do I make this right with her? And so he makes a cheeseburger. And then she's like, you know what? I think my eyes are bigger than my stomach. Can I get this to go?
That was great.
And, you know, she gets his go box and everything. And, like, he lets her go.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, the fact that, you know, the writer's room decided to, you know, have it, you know, have the movie built up where, you know, like, you know, Mara keeps getting hit with all of Julian's, you know, self-absorption. And then she throws it back at him and it's worse on him than it is on her. It's that really sounds to me a lot, and that's what I love. You know, another thing I love about this movie too.
Yeah, it's a clever, like as you were describing it, and like even just relaying the scene again, it kind of made me think like what kind of is happening is you have what Slowik was trying to do almost is like either upend the eating experience. So of course, so the whole movie, they say the menu, the metaphor is life. Yeah. Okay. So with what I'm saying, like think about life. So you have Slowik who has been observing that this experience of eating and the restaurant system, and he's been very pointed to criticize it and say like, this is sick, twisted. It's not what it was all about. And like, if you've been a regular to my restaurant, he talks to the old couple. He's like, you guys have been regulars. You've been here like 16 times. You think it's only 11. Name one thing you ate. And they can't.
Yep.
They get it completely wrong.
Yep.
And like, so he's really coming at like, this is not right. But he's also conflicted because he's like, but I'm at the top. So like, what do I do? So this is where the cult stuff comes in. They're like, hey, let's just self-destruct and go down. What's really cool about the final scene, and I think like what's great about the directing and even the music here, like you said, where it's like the burger with Colin Stetson's music is so pulled together, the combination of the silliness and the serious, is that like the system finally is doing what it does best. Somebody has an issue and is also hungry. The person who has the ability and the service to provide the need is like, what can I do for you? And she's just like, I just want a burger. Like, can I just eat some food? And then he's doing it and realizing, and it's like the only time he smiles in the movie in a genuine way, at least that's what's fed to us by the film and the filmmaking, is when he's making this meal that is simple, messy, and silly and greasy and gonna clog you up, but it feels so good to eat. Mm-hmm. And it's a double burger, which is even better. So it's like, it's delectable, and it becomes by the end of the movie, the thing that's the most appealing to you in the audience. That like, when you look at the metaphor, it's not specific, which is of course ironic because of the Adam McKay thing, but it's saying like, hey, when these systems work, at least I interpret it this way. When these systems work, they really come together in a really beautiful way where like, even when Margot eats the burger, I almost feel like she's performative because she's like, I got to get out of here and not die.
Yeah.
But then she's eating it and is like, oh, this is good. And of course, later she's going to, at the end of the movie, eat more of the burger.
Yeah.
But it just comes together, right? It all comes together in this way that's just like kind of wonderful. And I found it this rewatch, I found it even touching where like, yeah, that's what it's all about. Like work is a good thing when it can be good. And when it is good, it's really good to be able to provide and to do something like that.
Hey there, listener. Want to influence the podcast? Head on over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and support the show for $3 a month. In doing so, you'll be able to vote on a movie poll that picks a film we discuss each month. So jump on over there and have your voice heard.
Last thing I will say about the cheeseburger scene is that I don't know who was like the real life chef behind it that like it was charged with like, you know, cooking the food and all that, but that burger looked amazing and delicious. I gotta throw that out there. That burger actually truly looked amazing.
It was Guy Fieri. They had Guy Fieri. It's so bad.
It did look good. Whew. So there was of course there was that. Another scene that really stood out to me was the moment where Julian called out Tyler. And like how he is involved in the whole situation. Cause like we know like all the stories behind like all the other people there. You know, you had John Leguizamo's, you know, he's the movie star. And you know, you got the tech guys who, you know, who invested in the restaurant. Then you got the critic, you got the couple who are regulars. And then, you know, you're like, you know, how does Tyler fit into this? And we find out, he's really gonna bring a girl here on a date, and you know, he's a big fan of Julian Slowik. Mm-hmm. And we find out that previous girl, you know, it wasn't originally Margot, and you know, it was originally another girl, and you know, he brought Margot, you know, just to have an extra seat. But when Julian ropes Tyler into it and say like, you know, like why he's here, you know, he's like, I know you're a fan of my work, and so what I want you to do something for me, cook. And so Tyler, he goes, he goes and cooks something. I don't remember exactly what he cooks, but
trash.
it's some trash. And like Julian tries it, and like he not only does like he obliterate Tyler, you know, as you know, a hero, you know, not living up to the fans' expectations, mm-hmm. but like he destroys Tyler in a matter of seconds.
Yes,
and to the point where Tyler meets his ultimate demise, and you know. And dies on his own. I think that's a really interesting moment because, like, you know, the whole movie leading up to that moment, you know, Tyler, you know, he's setting Julian Slocum up to be like this big hero and like this, you know, the reason, you know,
kind of
like
total why, idol.
It's the idol. And, you know, and even like, you know, he would just like, you know, sit and like when all the horror stuff's happening, like he's just, you know, casually just, you know, sitting there eating his food while like all this stuff's like, you know, while Julian's, you know, chefs are, you know, breaking fingers. And you know, drowning people with angel wings, and mm-hmm. like even when they go outside, and you know, he has all the men, you know, go out for a run. Tyler doesn't run at first, and like he's just because like he's just sitting there, like you know, taking it all in. And right. Julian's like, "Oh, you too. Like you got to run as well." And he's like, "Okay." And you know, so like you know, we finally you know, Tyler's just he's just in for the experience, and like he thinks that's what it is. But then when he gets roped in, like when Julian calls him out specifically, you know, then we kind of see, you know, his true colors and, you know, Tyler's true colors.
Right.
And see his whole life and his whole preconceived image of Julian Slocum in his head completely fall apart. And it, you know, leads to his fallout.
What do you think the movie, like, so what I'm thinking of is like with the menu being like this metaphor for life and idols and pursuits and so many other things and classism. What do you think it is that the character of Tyler, his idolization and then self-destruction is kind of like, what is that in like the metaphor for life? Like, is there like something you can think of that like it connects to or is similar to, or,
I mean, it's like, you kind of hear some people say like, you know, you should never meet your heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel mm-hmm. like that was kind of the case with Tyler. Cause like, you know, we see people, you know, we see idols that we love, you know, whether it's on social media or on TV or in movies. And, you know, we think like, you know, they're like these amazing people. And then when we get the chance to meet them in person, you know, they can either be, you know, exactly who they are and, you know, be really genuine and nice, or at the same time, or they can be the exact opposite and just be like, you know, like just total dirtbags.
Oh yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, that was unfortunately that the latter is like what the case was with Tyler when he meets Julian Slowick, is that, you know, he ends up being a total dirtbag, and, you know, he gets crushed that, you know, that his hero, his idol, this person he's looked up to for years, you know, thinks he's a terrible cook.
And that's after having watched Jeremy's Mess. Like, so
yeah.
So the warning signs were there. He didn't have to do it.
And like he's totally thinking it's fair. Like, it's like he totally thinks like it's all like showmanship. It's like the critic said, like the critic's like, oh yeah, this is theater. It's just show.
Yes.
Right? And and Todd's like, oh yeah, this is theater. You know, and then it's just like goes cutting. Enjoying eating his food.
Doesn't,
you know,
bother him
casually,
at all.
Doesn't bother him at all. And like, but at least with the critic, you know, like she, at least she's looking into like, you know, like what Julian's true motives are. Tyler, he's just there for the experience. He's just there for the ride.
Yeah. Something that I didn't like connect, something that didn't connect with me the first time I watched it, but definitely did the second time, is that they specifically mentioned how Tyler, unlike everybody else who's there, Tyler has had an interaction with Slowick prior to the events of the film, and has already learned that everyone is going to die at the end of the dinner.
Yep.
And he, even though he knew that, he still brought a plus one. Not only mm-hmm. that he had scheduled to go with someone else who then broke up with him. I wonder why. but also then we learn Margot is a prostitute, so like a sex worker, so that he hired her to specifically just sit in to go to this dinner, knowing that she would just end up dying. So apart from the fact that he's totally disregarding her humanity to just be like, I just want to go to this dinner that if I don't have somebody, they won't let me go. It's also, he knows that if he just didn't go, he would at least live, but he's decided it's more important to do this dinner. So it's Tyler becomes like both somebody that's like frustrating and yet also like such a fascinating like he's simple as a character, but he connects to so many other details in the story that it actually makes him more compelling to look at and like put under the microscope. God, why did I not know what the word was? The microscope. And you start to see like, oh, it's like there's so many interesting things to see. Like, is there any reason that Slowik, I mean, Slowik undeniably is the villain. There's nothing that he's doing that's good. And any charisma he has is exactly the reason why anyone would be in his cult. It's because he's got the charisma to get your attention. But Slowik could have the opportunity to be like, hey, man, this idolization and the pursuit of getting to the top like I've gotten to isn't good. So don't do this or something like that. Yeah. But then he just decides, no, a better example is to have Jeremy. So earlier in the film, he kills himself and that's his dinner. That's the show in preparation for his dinner. But then also like has the same, it sounds like Jeremy has the same or had the same pursuit as Tyler. And yeah, to just end up finding out that they have the same result is like, you dude, you could have gotten out of here. But it makes him a much more interesting character.
So when I rewatched it recently, there was one moment that I thought to be kind of, you know, that gave me a little bit of a laugh that I didn't notice before. And it was, there's a moment where, Julian's about to, you know, introduce another next course and the movie, Johnny Gazamo's movie star, his movie star is like trying to talk his way out of it. And he's like, okay, well, at least don't kill my assistant. She's innocent. She's fine. Yeah. And then Julian's like, okay. And to the assistant, he says, where'd you go to college? And she's like, Brown. And he's like, student loans. She's like, no. He's like, I'm sorry, you're dying. Like, I don't know. Like, so like that, good. that hit me. That hit me on rewatch. I don't know why. But like, I remember like when I was logging on Letterboxd, like I was like, okay, what do I put here? And I'm like, okay, let's just do that quote and like just have it be there. Like that,
so
that whole
good
exchange of words.
Yeah, I appreciated the combination of like, because I do appreciate and enjoy a miserable movie. I think a miserable movie can be satisfying and still enjoyable. And in that way, like that's the joy of movies and storytelling is you can safely experience emotions and then you can take that and learn how to experience them well in the real world. But I also like that this movie has these moments of comedy that feed the moments and whatever and get you a good laugh, but then also help to say something. Because like you mentioned, Tyler's standing there when the one course is man's folly. They all are going to run away and the men can try and leave and escape unless they're caught. And if they're caught, then they, you know, have to stay for dinner. And Tyler doesn't leave to run away because he's like, well, I don't want to run away. I just want to stay. And it's like, oh, that's the point. That's the name of the course. It's your folly too. And all these like little things that are very funny. And that scene is funny, but also gets to its point. I was surprised that like, because sometimes movies that are funny like that and then also have the seriousness that this film has, usually that doesn't connect with people so well. I often find that people find that they don't know what they're supposed to feel. And it's like, well, just feel it all. It's okay. But yeah, I think even as we're getting into the more specifics, the more violent stuff in the film, like it comes across just fine. Like it's shocking as it's supposed to be, but it's not offensive. Jeremy kills himself, but it's not even like, it's not like Tarantino violence out of nowhere. That would be like, or a Sam Raimi thing. It's just like a gunshot wound cut to somebody else reacting, stuff like that.
Or like, you know, gunshot goes off and then the mess and like what all the ingredients are in it.
Yes. That's one of the best parts of the movie. I loved all that stuff.
I love that too. And I love how, like, you know, like even like with each dish, like, you know, like it shows it and then like it shows what's part of it. And like even when we get like Margo's cheeseburger, it's just like a simple cheeseburger. Or like at
it's
the end
so
when they have s'mores, they're like just, you know, chocolate, graham cracker, marshmallow, humans, or you know, humans, whatever else they have with it.
Want some quick updates on the podcast? Follow the Cinematic Doctrine Instagram for cool posts and story updates. Press the link in the show notes or search Cinematic Doctrine, that's one word, in your Instagram app. Oh, and we're on Threads. Check us out there too.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of chapter titles in movies. There's something about the pacing that I find compelling when you have like that kind of that system to it. And although these aren't chapter titles, they're very much in spirit chapter titles, because they have even the ingredients that are detailed. And I didn't know this until I read like a thing about the movie earlier, or a little after the second watch, was that like each ingredient and type of meal is definitely correlated to like the theme of the menu, which is like, duh, the movie told me that was the case. Why didn't I get it? But like even the first course is like a series of very young nature type. It's like a young, like young eggs. They're oxymoron. They're eggs. There's like sea salt. So it's like all these things that are very earthy and pre-evolutionary, I don't know what are the words to say, but birth theming, the beginning. And the whole point is like now they're eating it. So there's this decimation of it. It's indifferent. It's violent. It's killing this thing before it's alive, which goes in theme into the rest of the story, which is like this pseudo-nihilistic narrative that kind of unfails, which speaking of pseudo-nihilism, at the end of the movie, Margot is sitting in the boat as she has escaped. She is eating her cheeseburger. She's watching as the restaurant goes up in flames. Everyone's being killed. And she's eating the cheeseburger. And they say that the people get this complimentary package that they get to take home with them. Love that they give it to the people who die too, which I thought was really funny. Maybe that's the point of like, you can't take it with you. But with Margot, she has it. And they mention that the menu is given to everybody. And she just kind of looks at it and then uses it as a napkin, folds it up and like basically throws it away.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, I'm not one to always turn moments into movies and into poignant messages of something, but in terms of the film as a whole, what do you think is being like relayed to you in its final scene of the film by the fact that Margot's just using the menu as essentially trash?
Well, I think like, you know, with the ending as a whole, like to the rest of the movie, is that Julian finally, you know, he finally got what he wanted to do. You know, he had this grand, you know, meal that he wanted to create, and he tops it off with s'mores and, you know, giving everyone chocolate hats and, you know, marshmallow stalls. and essentially blowing the island up and everything on it. And, but to the point of like, you know, Margot using the menu as a napkin, I think it's just like a kind of like her, you know, let's say giving the bird, flipping the bird to Julian and everyone at Hawthorne, like, you know, just using it as a napkin is like her way of, you know, flipping the bird on them.
Yeah, it's very much a like, oh, it's like her putting her hands up in the air and being like, okay, like okay. Like, doesn't matter. Oh, you had this big extravagant show and you did all these things, but like, all right, like what's the big deal? Which is great, because like it's not even necessarily that, like, because there's nihilistic movies and then there's movies that maybe have a play at nihilism, and I would say like this is more the latter, where like Slowik has spent all of this time and this effort and this preparation doing this thing. And like, in a way, Margot has shown like at any point you could have just stopped. Like, you could have just gotten on this boat and left. And obviously there'd probably be jail time or something like that, but who knows? And maybe that's why he's like, he's choosing his heart. He's like, do I want to blow up in a s'mores infested explosion or jail time? I think I'll choose s'mores. But even that combination happening at the same time as the final course is s'mores, which he has this talk about, like, you know, innocence and this pining for better times. There is this way, and like, because it's at the end instead of the beginning, there's like a nostalgia happening at the end of the film where like the poison of nostalgia, maybe it's like Slowik has rejected nostalgia because he's like, I can't get back to my cheeseburger flipping days. But Margot's like, who told you can't? Like, who? And then to us as the audience, as people who might find ourselves like Slowik, who become self-destructive because of frustrating circumstance or others, there's nothing that kind of like changes that situation other than like a relative acceptance and I guess an empty stomach in need of a cheeseburger. But yeah, gosh, that cheeseburger making me think about it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it right now too, and I could use a cheeseburger right now too.
All right, we're an ASMR podcast now. We're gonna get some cheeseburgers and eat them really close to the microphone. what an awful experience that would be. I would not want to do that at all.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Another thing I will say about the ending is that I've heard a lot of people say they'll love the movie, but their one weak spot is the ending, or like people who didn't like the movie, mm-hmm. the one thing that stands out the most of why they didn't like it was the ending. I find it fitting.
Me too.
You know, I mean, I get it. I get why people who aren't big into it. To some people, it does seem a bit, you know, absurd. But I think in the context of the rest of the movie, you know, I don't see what's wrong with it.
I think like the pieces have been set up for it. Like it is definitely absurd. And sometimes the movie feels overly directed where it seems like when Slowik interacts with Tyler, there's a couple times where his expressions seem a little more extravagant. Which to me is like, I think they were just having too much fun on set and the director was like, do it big. And then they unfortunately picked that edit. But like, and the ending does feel a bit like that, where like the way Margot is staring at Slowik feels very, which of course it makes sense. She's pointed and affirmative, but there's, you know, we've watched Anya Taylor-Joy perform since as far back as The Witch. So, like, we know when she's natural, or at least we believe we know when she's natural and when not. And this felt a little more controlled, whereas, like, even when we cut back to Slowik, he seems much – Ralph Fiennes feels much more in control of his character as opposed to the director. I'm just presuming, but it comes across that way. And I even remember feeling that way a bit with the beginning – the first time – not the beginning, with the ending, the first time I watched it. And that combined with some of the visuals being a little silly for me. So the man with the wings being lowered into the water did not come across as dramatic to me as I think the film wants it to. And it also, if it's supposed to be funny, doesn't come across quite as funny as I think the movie wants it to for me.
Yeah.
And then the ending, I also can see like maybe some frustration with the visuals of the s'more, because I like the ending narratively. I like the ending somewhat visually and dramatically, but also something about the s'mores kind of just tops something like a little. It's not I guess it might be the word absurd. I guess it is. Where like it just comes across visually a little silly. When I think for me, like. I wanted it to be a little more serious. Like, I don't need chocolate topped hats. I don't know. Something I totally understand. Maybe like people when they saw it, seen it, and that's their criticism is the ending. Maybe that's it, where they're like, just a little too silly. Cause that was me. I like the movie a lot. I like it a lot, but it's got these like sillinesses that I wish maybe were a little more serious. I don't need maybe I do. I was going to say I don't need people crawling, burning on fire with s'mores. But then maybe I do. Maybe I need people's – like we get the one shot of the old woman with the chocolate and it's like going into her eye. That looked great.
Yeah.
Not as graphic as it might sound to anyone listening, but it looks good. Yeah. I don't know how much more you can do though when they're then just like they blow up. So it's just like, okay, there's nothing left. But
yeah.
Any final thoughts then, I guess, for the menu? Any last pitches to the listener? Or
if you're like me and like you're big into Succession, you haven't seen the menu, do yourself a favor and check it out. I would say like the humor in this movie is pretty similar to the humor in Succession, just like, you know, the dark, but yet, you know, oddly very hilarious. You know, I doubted the menu at first because like when I saw the trailer, I wasn't too big into it. But then like, you know, I heard the reaction at TIFF and like all the earlier reviews of it were like, we're saying it's really good. So like, okay, let's go check it out. Loved it. And I thought, okay, never doubt the people behind Succession. They made Succession. They can do, if they make something, just go with it.
No, the menu is really good. I 100% agree. I have friends that aren't big fans of horror, but then they watch something scary and they loved it. So I don't know. That's just how it is. But if you are one of those people who prefers thrillers or shooty McShoot Shoot gun movies, whatever, John Wick's. Watch The Menu. It's got the same tension as like any other thriller. It's just more conversational and dialogue heavy. And it's also very simple to understand in terms of metaphor. That's not me implying anyone listening is small brain. Just that, like, sometimes you just want to watch something and you want stuff spoon fed to you. Well, guess what? Go to Hawthorne. The dinner experience is very simple, and they will, in fact, spoon feed it to you.
Wonderful surprises await you at Hawthorne.
Oh, very much. Yes, it is. And I don't even think we spoiled as many of the character details or events in the movie. I genuinely think, like, when you check it out, you'll be able to still have a nice, fresh experience. But yeah, The Menu's good. If Mark Milo does another movie, I think I'm going to have to really get out there to check it out, because really enjoyed it.
Definitely.
Been itching for Cinematic Doctrine merch? Check out the support tiers on Patreon. We're offering merch to those who support at select tiers. So head on over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine and share your support. There's a link in the show notes too.
So, going to be pivoting into our recommendations. We'll be closing this episode out. So recommendations is very simple. We just recommend whatever. Can be really, I always say, like, movies are just fine because that makes it way easier. But yeah, did you want to kick us off then for recommendation?
Sure. So I don't know if anyone else has done this on your show, but like I'll just rattle off movies I've watched recently and, you know, that I recommend.
Perfect.
So first one I'll shout out is Martin Scorsese's 1974 film Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I'm going through Scorsese's filmography right now. I couldn't finish it all in time before Killers of the Flower Moon, but Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, it's on Netflix right now, and it's a great movie about second chances, and Ellen Burstyn is incredible in it. It's a really great uncut gem from the great Scorsese. So I watched that. There's another one I watched recently that I would recommend called Little Manhattan. It's this film from 2005 starring a very young Josh Hutcherson who lives in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And he meets this girl, who's about his age, like they're both about like 10, 11 years old. And like, you know, he experiences, you know, Josh Hutcherson's character experiences a love for the first time. And, it's just a cute, simple movie that I'd recommend. And if you love watching, you know, New York City as like a backdrop to a love story, you know, Little Manhattan's the way to go. And then the last, and I got a couple more. Another one would be I watched Your Name recently, which I've heard is Makoto Shinkai's best anime. Great movie. That's another good one. I watched Akira Kurosawa's High and Low. That was a great crime thriller from the 50s. So if you're into that, go check it out. And then lastly, I recently watched the first Best Picture winner of all time, Wings. And that's it's a pretty amazing movie. So that's what I'd recommend.
I've been really enjoying going back to early Hollywood stuff. So I might have to check out Wings real soon. Yeah, I think the last episode I just put up, I recommended a 1927 The Unknown, Todd Browning. Blew my mind. It was really good. That was like a shockingly good movie. Not because Browning's bad, quite the contrary, but just I was just so impressed by it. I'm just gonna recommend one that I caught recently. I've been watching a lot of East Asian horror movies. That was basically my thing last year, just like having a lot of fun checking out J horror because I hadn't seen it. Like I was too young when it was popular at the time and then phased out. So but then after J-Horror, I was checking out some other stuff, some of the directors in the field. And so then I saw that there was a 2022 movie that I missed. I knew it existed and I love found footage because it's just so nostalgic for me. But I hadn't seen it yet. So I decided, all right, fine, East Asian, let's get into it. So it's a Taiwanese film. It is Taiwanese found footage, folk horror, mom horror, cosmic horror movie. It is called Incantation. It's about 2 hours, a little too long in my opinion, but very, very, very compelling. Very, very easy watching. In fact, even in, I saw online just a brief trivia thing that was saying that in Taiwan, not only was it the highest grossing horror movie of the year, Or I think in general, I don't know. I can't, one of those, it was a big deal, but also it had such a big conversation regarding whether or not it was scary, which happens amongst, I would say, a lot of mom horror, frankly. And really any horror where it's about like families and then becomes high grossing or high watched is probably because, as I like to say, it's not just about moms, but it's horror your mom can watch, which means everyone's now watching it. Cause moms like horror. So, they're always reading Dean Koontz anyway, so they like scary stuff. But Incantation, let me tell you about the actual movie, though. So I describe everything about it except the movie. A mother, the beginning of the movie is the person, the found footage format, the person is talking directly to you. And they are just telling you about like intentions and how you can't always understand them, but you can always sort of you can sort of change them as you want. And then it does like a visual game. It shows you, it does that visual thing with the Ferris wheel, and it says it's going from left to right, right? And then it says, well, now you can make it go right to left. And it's because they're doing a low frame rate. And that's true. And then I say, we'll do it again with the subway. And they do it with the subway. And these are two visuals you've probably already seen before. And it's essentially saying like, you can just kind of change your intentions and your perspective just like that. And some things are like that. And then it kind of sets up like, okay, now I have this story that I need to share with you, because I need it to be understood, but you're going to have to repeat this for me. You can say it right back in your head. And then it gives you a chant. And that's the incantation. And then the movie starts. And we essentially learn like she gave her daughter up for foster care. And now 6 years later, she's getting her back. And but something's wrong with her. And she seems to be seeing things in her room. And so now we have two stories. We have that story where she's taking care of her daughter that she hasn't had for a while. And then years ago when she was on a ghost hunting show with her friends. So you can understand where all the stuff gets started. But it was really visually quite enjoyable to watch. I really enjoyed the direction it went. I thought the ending was mysterious and strong. I keep thinking about the ending, and although there are definitely parts that, like, in the moment you will go, oh, you could just cut this out of the movie, it's still worth it. And then lastly, just because at this point, just go watch all five movies we've recommended, all six movies we've recommended. The last thing I saw is I found one kind of obscure website that, since this movie's in Taiwan, it's not like it's easy for me to get press on it. But the website said that there may be a sequel due to its success. So if you like the movie, you can look forward to that, and some minor plot holes can be fixed out of that. But I digress. Incantation, it's on Netflix. Check it out. It is pretty cool. With that said, Tyler, thank you so much for coming onto this episode and enduring through this first time having a guest back onto the show, because I like to think I'm good at this, but I also know sometimes I'm not. So who knows how this will turn out? I guess I'll find out when I'm editing. I thought it was good. I thought it was great, but I really appreciated you coming on. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, Melvin, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm honored that I'm your first guest in a long time. And I think what you're doing here is absolutely fantastic. And if you'd have me, I would love to come back another time.
Hey, you name dropped your name, and we got anime coming up soon, so I might be reaching out. But where can people get connected with you, and is there anything you want people to know about before we go?
You can find me on Instagram at Tyler Banark Reviews Movies, Banark spelled B-A-N-A-R-K. I'm also on Letterboxd at Ty Banark Movies. That's the same handle on my Twitter. Of course, like I said earlier, you know, check us, I'm involved with, TLOC Productions on Instagram and, the League of Cinephiles on YouTube. We got season 4 right around the corners, and it's the final season, so it's going to be the biggest one yet. Feel free to, check us out there. And, I'm also writing for a site called thecinemadispatch.com. I got a lot more work coming within the next few months, so, be on the lookout for all that stuff.
Nice. Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks so much for checking out this episode of Cinematic Doctrine. If you enjoyed this episode, consider leaving a review and subscribing to the podcast. And as mentioned before, Cinematic Doctrine has a Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you're opted into a once-a-month movie poll where you decide a movie we discuss on the podcast. There are other unique benefits that come with supporting the podcast, so be sure to check that out at patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine. A special shout out to those who support at the Art House Theater tier on Patreon. Thank you so much, Mom, Dad, Melanie, Sherlion, and Thomas. You guys are the best, and your continued monetary support is greatly appreciated. Until next time, stay cool. Want some Cinematic Doctrine swag? You're in luck. We've got 3-inch Cinematic Doctrine logo stickers exclusive for Patreon supporters. Perfect for your travel mug or laptop. Head over to patreon.com/cinematicdoctrine, link in the show notes, and choose the independent theater tier. Doing so will net you other perks too. But let's be real, the podcast stickers are the coolest perk. So get yourself some podcast stickers by supporting on Patreon.